Hey gang, quick bit of housekeeping for you before we start the show. And this is only relevant to those of you who listen to us on the Apple Podcasts app or via Apple. So if you don't, move along, as the great Obi-Wan Kenobi would say, nothing to see here. But if you do listen to us via Apple, listen carefully, particularly if you're an old school listener of the show. Before we became the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN, when we were the NFL show, you would have got the show updated when we moved without having to do a thing. But that's because the old show had a divert put on it. So to check, you're subscribed to the new feed, because the old one is going to go pretty soon. Check out the Nat Coombs Show. Search for it on the app via the podcast browse section or the store section if you're looking on the desktop, and find our show and see if it shows whether you're subscribed or not. If you are, great, you're on the right feed. If you're not, hit subscribe and delete the old one. So head on over, not in your library, but actually onto Apple. Search the Nat Coombs Show. Make sure you're subscribed to the feed that you find. Simple. Good luck. Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN. Now, we promised you some extra episodes throughout the spring, throughout the lockdown, and we have one for you right now. Ollie Connolly, who many of you will know, of course, NFL writer for The Guardian, amongst others, has written a terrific piece about Michael Vick. And we thought, well, let's get him on to talk about it. Incidentally, if you're interested in Vick, head on over to ESPN Player. There is a two-part 30 for 30 documentary all about him. Of course, the 30 for 30 series, terrific. And ESPN Player carries all of them, including the Michael Vick. So go and check that out over on ESPN Player. Right, let's get straight down to it and check in with Ollie Connolly. Ollie, great to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
So we're going to talk about your brilliant piece on Michael Vick, which I think posed a lot of really interesting questions. We'll get to that in a bit. But before we do, you've been writing for The Guardian for a fair bit. So seeing as it is your debut on the show, I want to understand where your love of the NFL, when it started, where it came from, and on a professional basis, how long you've been writing for them, and some of the other stuff you do. So let's start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. When did you first discover the game?
Oh, wow. Years and years ago, my dad used to, what I think in hindsight is a wonderful parenting strategy, calling taking your son on the road, throwing some Sports Illustrateds at him, and then leaving for work.
Genius. I love it. I like your dad already.
And then I would just carve through them all the time. My first love at that point was baseball and the Boston Red Sox. And then one time on a cover, they had this great cover story of a quarterback at a high school in Florida, Nice High School. I remember that. Who played the game, finished the game with a broken leg and scored a winning touchdown. And I was like, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. And that quarterback turned out to be Tim Tebow.
Wow. Okay. So that, now I'm getting the era as well and feeling very old at the same time. So it's interesting. It's Sports Illustrated. It came up the other day, actually, briefly. We had Stig Abel on a pod recently, and we were talking about sports, American sports writing, and in particular, books, but obviously we drifted into journalism, and one of the things we recommended was the Halberstam collection. He edited the collection, the best sports writing of the century, and we got onto Sports Illustrated obviously as a result. And it is, irrespective of the times we're living in right now, it's a difficult time for publications like Sports Illustrated, that same with me, so seminal, so important in my formative years and now. And there's nothing better, I think, than going into Smith's and trying to find a news agent that still stocks it. But it's challenging times, isn't it, as a journalist, for titles like Sports Illustrated, because of primarily, I guess, the digitization of everything. They're a dying breed, aren't they?
Yeah, it's not just the digitization, it's the management at top of those publications. And they just become these soulless, we live in an odd time where there's not enough fearlessness in the writing anymore. You go back through the archives of Sports Illustrated, the best pieces are the most fearless ones. They just almost do not care. There was not schmoozing with the players. There was less agent involvement, all that kind of stuff. And there was more of a detachment because we're so close to these athletes now on a day-to-day basis.
And scared to offend, you mean?
Is that absolutely? Yeah, because I'm not even sure if it was offense more so than they were, because they had almost the bully pulpit. So they were going into the locker room almost as equals at that time. And you just don't have that. It's so, I mean, you can't write a piece about LeBron now without getting it back for him. If you were at Sports Illustrated and you wrote a massive piece on LeBron, you would have to negotiate with his camp to get any kind of access, or you wouldn't get a morsel. And then if it was bad, you would never speak to him ever again. And you can't have to have those titles anymore.
I remember early on in my career, one of the first kind of major things I did, I won't name it or say what it was, but I was presenting wise, I was doing a show. It was the very first episode of that show, and we were rehearsing, and I'd written a piece that kind of link into a package, and it had a pretty, I think, not particularly offensive, but better say, but had a gag about a certain player, and it certainly wasn't anything too contentious, right? But it was a pop at a player, playful, I think it was, if we would describe it as, and went to, in rehearsals, so cut to this piece, and while the VT was running, we were rehearsing in my ear, my producer said, "Nat, yeah, we're gonna have to change that link." And this is my very first show. So I just kind of nodded and went, well, okay, sure. And we changed it. And at the end of recording, I said, just out of interest, why did I have to change that link? And he said, I'll come over here. And he said, the player you were talking about, who played for Man City at the time, we have got a whole lot of interviews lined up with City. And if that went out, would be curtains. And it was like, okay, that was my first awakening to this is not as straightforward as it should be, and there are a huge amount of politics involved. So yeah, I take your point. I hear that. So Sports Illustrated formative years, really, really. So I guess falling in love with the sports, but also that, was that when you thought this is where you realized I wanted to be a writer? Was that starting to formulate?
Well, I was kind of a strange kid. I was good at sports, pretty good at like a county level of things, cricket, football, and what have you. But I always just wanted to write. I ran my own newspaper in a Microsoft Word document every day.
Wow.
I had a cover story. I had my own column. I was very excited about that. I had like a news story and a back page, and I would go in and I would put the picture in. And then on the inside, I would write my own daily column, and it would be football, cricket, baseball. It would be anything. So from the age I can remember, that is what I wanted to do. And I always remember, and I am very ashamed of this right now, I always wanted to be on Sunday Supplement. Rather than like playing in Super Sunday after Sunday Supplement, I wanted to be on Sunday Supplement. That was like my dream, to be sat next to Martin Samuels and just cutting up the shop.
Love it. Well, that dream could still be alive. I hope. Have you made your Sunday Supplement debut yet?
Not yet. No. Oh, but okay. I have been around those guys, and that is a pinch yourself moment. Like, wow, this is all I ever wanted. And it is not all that's cracked up to be.
Well, it's led you to, well, The Guardian is where most of our listeners will know you from, of course, in your writing. And you've been writing for that for a good couple of years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is more sports and culture, which is a departure for me, really. Most of my stuff has been nerdy, schematic things, scouting. That's been most of my career. And then to go over there and write about the intersection of sports and culture, where you get to things like a Michael Vick and the politics of basketball, baseball. It's a bit of a departure for me, but it's awfully invigorating.
What advice would you give to young writers specifically listening to our show? Well, actually, let's scratch the young writers out there, aspiring writers that want to continue to do it if they've started and professionalize it if they haven't been able to yet. What advice would you give to be able, given what we just said about the changing dynamic of journalism and the saturation in the market, that one of those fundamental aspects, I guess, of this ability for anybody to be able to, so let's take you as a kid in your Word doc, you know, you, I don't know if, again, trying to sort of date this, maybe you did publish it, but certainly now you could, right? Straight away, you could publish that, and draw readers and draw followers straight away. And that is wonderful in the sense that you, whether it's writing, whether it's a podcast, video, whatever it is, you can build a following straight away. You have an access to a market. But the flip side of that, of course, is that there is so much competition now, and it's very difficult to get heard. So what advice would you give to writers out there that want to follow in your footsteps?
The biggest thing is just to do it, is just to write and read. The big thing I see now, I get so many people coming to my DMs or emailing me saying, hey, can you help me out and stuff? And I'll sit and I'll regularly do phone calls with people and try and help them out, just email exchange back and forth. And I often are stunned by how little they read. It's writing. They write, which is excellent. And I think if you want to be a writer, you should wake up and try and write every day. Even if it's bad, just do it bad for yourself in a Word document. Do it on a blog that no one's reading. I came up in the era of the blogosphere, and I was just too nervous. I was writing that newspaper to myself for a shameful amount of time. I didn't ever put it somewhere. It was just me writing away every day in my Word documents. And then eventually I put it onto a website. So you just have to do it, and you have to write. And I always had a rule coming up, and I hate evangelizing about like how my way is the way type thing. But I would always try and read at least three things to one thing I wrote, whether it was an article, a book or whatever. Mm. And one thing I used to do back in the day, which is not a good idea, but did somewhat help, is I would take my favorite columnist, was Dan Le Batard, who does the radio show for ESPN now.
Sure.
Sensational writer back in the day for the Miami Herald. I would take his columns, change the subject and try and write in his tempo.
Wow. Which makes
him sound like a serial killer, I understand, but I would say.
Well, that's fascinating because that's kind of like if you kind of appropriate that to comedy writing, you know, that is very much the model, certainly in the States, of how a lot of sitcom writers took, where to get an agent in the first place, they'd have to write a spec script. They'd have to write a script of an existing sitcom to get attention, to get an agent to take them on before they could write or even sell any of their original work. So I guess that's a similar kind of process.
Yeah, just kind of steal Seinfeld's voice and offer it around.
I was thinking Frasier in my head, but yeah.
I'll take it. I would take it. And if Dan did three words in a sentence, I would do three words in a sentence. And you learn over time, like, well, I like that, I don't like that. And you just have to read. And eventually, like they say, you find your own voice.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, you certainly have. And, I really, really enjoy your writing and your style as well. And the Michael Vick column that you've written recently is something that I thought on so many levels was interesting. Let's start with the more straightforward and the headline, I guess, demonstrates this. Should Michael Vick be in the Hall of Fame? And that opens up, I guess, a duality in terms of fundamental questions relating to this. Michael Vick specifically, and then what attributes, what requirements are there for a player to make it into the Hall of Fame? And you pose the question because you say, look, you look at Michael Vick's career, which was disappointing, really, when you think about the ability that he had. You think about the lack of, you mentioned this in the piece, the lack of individual and team success that he demonstrated throughout his career. Statistically, it doesn't really stack up, but nevertheless, he was undeniably a game-changing style of quarterback. He was a quarterback that moved the position on, the most influential position in all of sports, I think it's fair to say. And he was inspirational. And as you said in the piece, he was the kind of player that seasoned heavyweight defenders couldn't deal with. They couldn't, in his prime, in his pomp, they just couldn't handle. So let's start with that, the Hall of Fame element to Michael Vick. Do you think that there is an argument to say that statistics and success, rings in particular, shouldn't be the complete story here? Because it seems to be most of the time in the Hall of Fame that it should, and that there should be an element of intangibles. There should be aspects of what a player has stood for and the kind of player, the impact that a player has had on a generation and on his contemporaries, that should be given equal footing to black and white numbers.
I think so. I think if we're just doing an exercise in statistics and it's like this guy won two rings and this guy had X number of rushing yards and he hung on at the tail end for 3 years to get to a certain total, so we give him a gold jacket, it's kind of like, well, what are we doing with that exercise? Shouldn't we just pull up a spreadsheet then and go, that guy was pretty good? If the idea is to have it as a museum or as this kind of physical place where you can go and study the history of the game, and most of it is in the air, it's in the atmosphere. No one actually goes to Canton outside of the guys with the gold jackets, right? But it is this notion, this moniker, and it does have real value. You go and look at all the pre-games and post-games and mid-show games, and all those guys have gold jackets, and if they don't, the big punchline is that the one guy doesn't have the gold jacket.
Sure.
So it matters. And I think that you should be trying to tell the story of the game, that we should have the kickers who kicked without shoes. Those guys should be in there. These are wild stories that map and chronicle the history of the game. And Vic is probably the most controversial candidate on that. And it gets down to, should you have a morality clause? How does that stuff factor in? Do you do on the field, off the field? Well, if we're not doing stats anymore, then surely the off the field does come into it some more. Do you want to tell the story of that side of the game? Well, then do you want to sugarcoat it? So it's this awfully nuanced thing that's hard to dig down into.
Well, and that's
probably the most fascinating character.
On that, let's look at morality then, because obviously, irrespective of the the playing component, the character component with Vic, as you say, is undeniably challenging, right? When you're evaluating him, but it opens up the question, how important is that when you're evaluating the significance of a career? And the Hall of Fame, I guess, adds a different nuance to that. So let's apply that. Should a player's character and what they do off the field have any bearing on whether they make the Hall of Fame?
I think I personally separate the art from the artist, but I'm not strident. If it's a certain thing, then yes, I will change my mind. I've never in my life brought into the concept of the slippery slope. I find that hilarious. I think, well, you can just stop. You can just say, well, this thing will take on a case-by-case basis. And if you brought in the morality clause, you would have to look at, well, someone like O.J. Simpson, well, he's found guilty in a civil suit, but he's not found guilty criminally. So if we just put down a set bar that it's criminal cases that we can't have him in, well, then what if some guy gets caught with something in one era, but then that doesn't become a legal issue in future eras? Mm. So it is really, really hard. The thing with Vic is that it is such a heinous crime that he's pled guilty to, that it throws it into this hole of the stratosphere. If it was as simple as awful as that sounds, an OJ, and Aaron Hernandez, someone along those lines, it does become more black and white. The Michael Vick situation is so, so difficult. And I don't have the answer in my own head. I just trying to think through these things. My editors go crazy at me. It's like, well, what's the answer? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. Let's just discuss it because it's fascinating to me. You cannot tell the story of the NFL without Michael Vick. And yet I think it's appropriate that if you were having this, you know, the scene would be the mom or the dad taking the son or daughter around Canton, right, to show them this is the history of the game. This is the lineage. The fact that he's not in is in and of itself the perfect lesson, I think.
Yeah. And that was your conclusion, which I thought was brilliant. But on the aspect of rehabilitation, which America loves, and in fact, Vic was, a comeback player of the year, right? Mm-hmm. When he came back and played for Philly, he was a comeback player of the year. And that in itself is quite an ambiguous award, right? Is it based on, coming back from an injury? Is it coming back from poor performance? Is it coming back from something in Vic's case, quite probably an absence from the game that was self-inflicted and returning to, if not identical, then similar levels of performance on the field? And that acknowledgement, I guess, or that award acknowledged a significant step in terms of his rehabilitation, didn't it? So, and America loves a story, whether it, removing it out of the world of sport, you look at showbiz and entertainment, America likes to take somebody who has fallen on bad times, often self-inflicted, and enables them to come back and to be forgiven. Now, to your point on the crime specifically and how heinous it was, and again, I'm sure all of our listeners know this, but in case there are any that don't, maybe for whatever reason didn't follow the game at the time and don't know a huge amount about Vic, he was found guilty of being involved with competitive dog fighting, where dogs were fighting to the death, and he was enabling this, quite a key protagonist in this, right? And he is, to his credit, he has all never denied it. He's held his hands up to accept the severity of the crime and how morally reprehensible it is. And he has worked pretty much ever since he was involved with it to rehabilitate his character and to try and address that specific area and that specific, which he, at the time there, we cited a lot of cultural reasons for it as well, which is not to be dismissed when we consider all of this. But he is gone for many years on and followed a path of, if not out and out virtue, then certainly he's a much stronger character over a sustained period of time. So is that an element when you think about it? You're looking at the Hall of Fame, and the reason you write the piece is because his eligibility is now active, right? Is there an argument to say, Ollie, that you can't possibly condone what he did, but at the same time, you can applaud and reward his rehabilitation?
I think you can you can look at it and say, one of the big things with him is that he served his time. And so then what are we as a society if he is continually punished for the crime he committed? Now, also, it's not a right to get elected to the Hall of Fame. He got his freedom back. That was what he served the time for. And he got his job back eventually once he served the time. And he is still a cultural phenomenon to a large portion of the population, specifically to people of a video game age. And something I didn't put in the piece that I think is somewhat fascinating and could come into play maybe 10 or so years down the line is as the old guard ages out and what they deem to be the criteria for the Hall of Fame and basically the video game era of Madden ages into the Hall of Fame block. What impact will that have on someone like a Vic and the people like, you see, Lamar Jackson and guys of that ilk? When they are aging into a category where they'll say, well, our pioneer was, we know about Randall Cunningham, but for us, it was Michael Vick. That will be a fascinating thing. And I think as we get further removed from it, that yes, there'll be more of a focus on him as this kind of pioneering figure, what he meant culturally and societally for Atlanta and then for the African-American community as well. And maybe less of a focus. That stuff will always be there. It has to be. It is almost the key thing that comes up with him. But from a football perspective, I think as that old guard ages out, he gets more of a chance.
Well, a really great point you make in terms of the cultural significance, not just generational, but point taken on that as well, but the impact that he had. And you mentioned Randall Cunningham, and that is a great example. Vic was obviously not the first black quarterback in the NFL, and there have been players, Cunningham in particular, whose style Vic mirrored, but Vic, it can be argued, and statistically, this is borne out. I think he rushed for almost twice as many yards as Cunningham, or thereabouts. So he took that aspect, I think, to the next level. And he was a player, as you say, that was in Atlanta. You talk about this in the piece during a real boom time for hip hop in Atlanta, and Vic became a figure of optimism and hope and aspiration for so many young black Americans. And that, surely that aspect needs to be factored in when you're looking. And your point about Vic being a fundamental part in terms of the evolution of the game and the story of the game is quite clearly defined by what he did on the field, but again, off the field and what he stood for, that should surely be a key component of whether somebody is selected into Canton or not.
Yeah, he is also a key figure in the black story in America. If you look at that time period in sports, you have the NBA instituting a dress code, right? You have Allen Iverson and hip-hop aligning with basketball as it always kind of has done, and then the NBA trying to stamp it out basically. Whilst you have the most conservative sport in America, the NFL, you have this guy who is from Atlanta, well, is from Virginia, is playing in Atlanta, aligns himself wholeheartedly with the exploding hip-hop scene there, and yeah, he has a no bleeps attitude and people love that. And it's not just people in Atlanta, it is a whole generation of people and a subsect of people who just fall for it. And you get the awful now moral dilemma for them, right? Which is like, this guy is so meaningful to us for what he represented and he did this thing, but then he's also getting lambasted for that. And does that have a racial element? Is there a racial element to that? But then he did do the awful things. So he is one of the most fascinating divisive figures in just American society and history, let alone like the NFL as the body.
Why don't you think Vic lived up to his potential? Is it fair to say he didn't live up to his potential? I'm not talking about how many rings, because there are so many different contributing factors there. And, the obvious examples are Marino and Warren Moon. I think you list actually in terms of the Hall of Fame quarterbacks that have been elected since 2000, almost all of them have been to at least one Super Bowl, but we understand the counter argument there of either the over importance placed on rings. All of those who feel that Eli Manning shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame will point to that. The flip side of that is all of those who do think he should be in the Hall of Fame will point to the significance of rings. Vic didn't achieve any collective success, but on an individual level, was it the disruption and the time that it came? And there was an injury before that, wasn't there? So was it the 2006 season he was injured?
Yeah.
Then this all kicked off in the summer of 2007. So he was basically out of the game for 4 years or so, wasn't he? Would we be talking about a very different situation, irrespective of the factor of the dogfighting, if Vic had played through most of those years and built up more and more numbers, whether or not he made it to a Super Bowl or not? Would that make the on-the-field performance argument a little bit more straightforward?
It would make it a little bit easier, but I'm not so sure. I mean, he came up in a time where just schematically it was not designed for him, right? And he had that early success, and then the Falcons went completely away from it. We saw a little hint of what it could have been with Chip Kelly for the little time, and wasn't that so tantalizing if we had had Michael Vick out of college in a pace and space system and all the spread option stuff that we're running these days, then that's what we would have had. But without Michael Vick, we may not have got to that evolution as fast as we did. Coaches all right. across the country going, well, why are they taking the best athlete and not doing this with him? If we're going to play the best athlete at quarterback, let's make him athletic. Let's do some athletic stuff. And so you get the boom in spread option principles, not because of Michael Vick, but he certainly helps speed up the evolution of the process. So I think that it's more so just the time period he was in that kind of constricted him. Then by the time he gets to someone who can use some of his gifts, then he's kind of aged out of his prime, and we lost two of his prime years to obviously the dogfighting scandal as well. The individual award stuff and all that jazz, I think it's bigger than that. You know, I think it is about the evolution of the game. Do I think he was the best quarterback at any time in the NFL? No. Should people making the Hall of Fame have that against their name? Probably. But I just think that his case should be on a higher level than that.
And as evidenced by, we put this out, we tweeted your article out and asked some of our followers on Twitter what they thought about it. And it's unsurprisingly divided opinion. I mean, I think your conclusion is that the most appropriate end note here is, well, I'll quote you directly, his absence from the Hall of Fame will speak more appropriately to his career than his induction ever would, which is a beautiful way of putting it. And I think that tended to be the response from our listeners who responded on Twitter, that I think everybody understands that the flaws in Vic, both on the field and certainly off. But it raises such an important number of questions in terms of what makes a player eligible. And I wonder your point on generational change, whether we will start to see in 20, 30 years, maybe sooner, a shift in the kind of players that are inducted into the Hall of Fame and the reasons why they're inducted, or whether it will remain, as we started this conversation, based primarily on the stats, the numbers, and the ultimate success, both individually and collectively. It is an interesting subject. Ollie, thanks for joining us. What have you got next? What are you up to, you know, during these difficult times? I guess we've got you've got to get quite inventive with your writing at the moment.
At the moment, yeah. Well, the NFL is pushing along. We have the draft and all sorts of stuff. The NFL just seems to say we are immune from this, so we'll just keep going.
What's your hunch on the season starting on time?
Oh, if anyone can make that happen in any walk of life, it is 32 NFL owners.
Yeah, yes, right. 31 of the Packers, yeah?
yeah, it's true. Yeah, no one matches that level of collective arrogance, so they will just find a way to do it.
It'll get there. There's too much money riding on it. Yeah. It's been really good to chat to you. Thanks for dropping by, and I hope you come back soon.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Very much enjoyed the chat with Ollie. He's a great writer. Head on over to The Guardian to read all his NFL stylings, and we will push out a link to the Michael Vick piece, and we'll definitely be checking in with Ollie before too long. Also, as I said at the top of the show, ESPN Player is where you can watch the Michael Vick 30 for 30 documentary. It's in two parts. Head on over to Player and go and enjoy. Right, we're back Friday. Iron Mike in the house for more NFL news and updates.